Now, if you want to, you should just go out and come back in. If you want to go out and have, I don't know, go to the toilet, whatever you want to do. But it's an opportunity now to ask some questions, and like, I think you should have a go. So has anybody got any questions? No? Oh, one down here. Oh, I know you. You have to shout. Oh, well, yeah, but if you've got a question, you can try and shout it out so we can hear it. Anyway, yeah.
Right, my question is for both of you, so if you could both answer it, that would be good. Basically, if there's one thing that you think people...
Yeah, shout it out.
Oh, right.
Or stand up.
Oh, okay. If there's one issue that you think, or one question that you hope the average person should be thinking about at the moment... what would it be?
One question which the average person should be thinking about. Well, I think when we look at a great struggle against injustice in the past, as the movement for emancipation of the slaves was, I think it should force us to direct our attention to similar struggles going on today. I think at the top of my agenda, and perhaps that partly has to do with coming from the country that's responsible for it, would be doing everything possible to stop the war in Iraq right now.
That's a beautiful voice. One in the back here.
In 1807, with the abolition of the slave trade, those trafficking in the slave, the merchants, the slave owners, they were compensated. There's a figure about £20 million at the time. And in 1825, 26 year later, at the abolition of slavery, the plantationers were also compensated. The only party involved in this that weren't compensated were the slaves themselves, who by their labor produced the wealth that we see here in Bristol, where we live.
And you can.
Isn't it time now for that party to be compensated? They are the descendants of slaves still in Jamaica, still in the former colonies in the Caribbean, also even here in Bristol. They have not inherited the wealth that their forefathers labored and died for. With this one whole year of events, celebrating or having programs to highlight the abolition of slave trade, in which the slaves were still slaves, when are they going to be compensated, or should they be compensated?
Yeah.
But should, I don't think there's any doubt.
Yes. Ooh, that's right.
But how? That is a complex question. And I think that some mechanism should be set up in order to look at ways in which the overwhelming majority of the population whose origin is in slavery in many of the Caribbean territories, how that compensation could be given. Obviously, on an individual basis, it probably would be unworkable. But some methods could be worked out for compensating the peoples on a national scale. Mm-hmm. What that should be, I really have not given any thought to at all.
I guess I would look at it a little bit differently. It seems to me that more important than compensating people for past injustices, because I think you're right, it's very hard to work out a system for doing that in a fair way, would be to force our attention to the systemic injustices that there are in the world right now, because any kind of compensation or reparations payment are going to mean nothing if we continue to have a globalized trading system that is so much set up for the benefit of wealthy countries and multinational corporations. You know, the way that that redistributes the wealth of the world into the hands of those who already have it far outweighs anything that can be done in compensation payments. For example, look at the way the U.S. and Canada, Europe and Britain have high tariffs that prevent agricultural produce produced in Africa from competing on the world market. If you eliminate something like that, it eliminates an enormous injustice in the world today, and there's so many other things about how the system of globalization works. I think we should focus our attention on these injustices that exist right in the world today, and make that the first line of attack.
I'm not meant to comment normally because I'm meant to pick people out, but I'd like to make two comments about that. First of all, I'd like to say last night I was at a talk where Jim O'Neill explained where that compensation money that was given to the slave owners and the merchants in Bristol went. And it went into stimulating Bristol industry, which involved, I think, at one point, they opened a cotton mill in Barton Hill, where they employed 1,000 people. This is slave money paid out of British taxes to compensate people who have been, like, you know, exploiting the wealth of millions of hours of labour, of forced labour in the Caribbean. That money went to making a cotton mill in Barton Hill, where they employed 1,000 people, which 700 were children. And they worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and if they didn't go to work, they were imprisoned. Now, what I'd like to say is that I think compensation and what we're talking about here is very important. But I also think it's put in the wider context of the exploitation of huge numbers, millions of people across the world, actually. And I think, obviously, that money went out of the Caribbean and that labour was exploited, that money came back here. But also, it was also used to exploit millions of working class people in this country as well. Now, I'm not saying they're equal, but I don't think it's as easy to say that, you know, compensation should be applied to just one group. That money was used to exploit working class people in Bristol, and I wonder why Barton Hill is not full of mansions like Clifton is. Right? There's reasons for that. So I think the complexity is that system goes right across the city, goes right across the world. It's not just about one place and another place, but that's my view. Let me shut up. Next question.
Yeah, you referred to the revolt in Haiti, San Domingo, which was in 1790. What was the impact of that upon the slave revolts in the 19th century? Because in the Haiti revolt was the only revolt, wasn't it, where the slaves actually freed themselves, where they defeated the British Army, French Expeditionary Force. How well known was that, you know, of Toussaint-Louverture and that revolt? How well known was that amongst the slaves in the Caribbean? And to what extent did it act as an impetus for further kind of resistance?
Well, first of all, the effect of it on the establishment. Many abolitionists were so alarmed at what happened in Haiti that they suspended their agitation for some time because they were afraid that the timing was bad in view of what had happened in Haiti. They weren't interested in influencing the slaves. They were interested in influencing people with money and influence. As to the effect that it had on the slaves, so far as it was known, of course, it must have had an exciting influence because that showed that it was, in fact, possible. But I have no detailed information on that.
You know, somebody just discovered something recently that wasn't known before. Richard is right that a lot of the abolitionists, Wilberforce especially, were horrified, not just at the revolt in Saint-Domingue, Haiti, but at specter of slave revolts anywhere, because they were afraid it would make it more difficult to get any sort of bill past the British Parliament. However, Thomas Clarkson, who as a young man was very much a radical, a big enthusiast of the French Revolution, someone just recently discovered, going through old issues of a provincial newspaper in Ipswich, that he wrote a number of articles about the great slave revolt in Haiti that were published there, probably unknown to Wilberforce and the more conservative members of the committee. I think that's why he published in a provincial newspaper and not in London. But certainly the eyes of the world were very much on that revolt, because we should not forget that the Haitian slaves, over 13 years of fighting, defeated the old French colonial regime, an army that Napoleon sent against them when he tried to reestablish slavery after he took over in France, and they defeated the British army. The British army fought for 5 years to try to capture that colony for itself and to suppress the slave revolt before it could spread to Jamaica. And after 5 years and a huge number of casualties, they pulled out.
Jim, first, and then Jim.
I think if you want compensation, you should ask the banks. You should ask Rothschilds, Barings, Lloyds, Barclays, and NatWest, because that's where the money went, in the international banking system. And that's who should give the most generous rates to those colonies and those people to try and build up their economies. But there'll be strings to it. But the other thing is that the words that you spoke by Sam Sharp was an absolute international hero of international standing, world standing. They're the words of Tom Paine, and they're the words of the French Revolution and the American Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, and that thing that all men or women were equal. And you can see that thread, and that was the same thread that was happening in England as well, with the big movements and revolts in Great Britain and elsewhere in the world. It was a world movement of people towards equality and freedom, and to overthrow the aristocracy. It was a world movement.
Yeah, maybe Adam, you could say something about the piece of rock from the Bastille.
Yeah, Clarkson, when the French Revolution broke out in 1789, the Abolition Committee immediately sent him to Paris to be the liaison with the French abolitionists. But he went directly to the Bastille, which had been stormed a few weeks before, and they were in the middle of demolishing it. And he brought home a stone from the Bastille, which he kept in his living room for the rest of his life. So this was a remarkable time. And, you know, there are still echoes of that time and the unfulfilled dreams from that time, which should be motivating us today.
Yeah,
I just wanted to ask you both, really, why you think
Bristol and Britain doesn't apologise for its role in Haiti. Because I think it was last November that Tony Blair expressed a statement of regret, but he didn't say sorry. And I wondered how you both felt. Bristol obviously has a lot to apologise for, but I would be very surprised if we do get an official apology. You see, the brainwashing that took place for centuries over the question of the abolition of slavery was designed to bring credit to Britain and make heroes of British abolitionists. And no mention was made of the part played by the slaves. And this was effective in the colonies too. I remember in Jamaica as a young man talking to an old lady in a rural area who, with a sort of little curtsy, assured me, "Is Mrs. Queen giving freedom?" that message was really put across very effectively. That is really, as I sometimes put it, what interested me in doing research into the abolition of slavery was all for the wrong reasons, because I wanted to give the newly formed People's National Party, which had been just formed in 1938, I wanted to give a background of the struggle of the people and what difference that could make. I mean, this was in colonial times. So I think that it was very important to, in fact, inspire people with the example of what the slaves had done in Haiti and in their own country.
You know, about apologies, I'm not sure that apologies really count when politicians apologize for something that was done a couple of hundred years ago. I just care so much more about rectifying injustices in the world today. I think it's, you know, it offers politicians a way out if they stand up and apologize for something 200 years ago when there are so many injustices of all kinds surrounding us today. I would judge people by their actions on that and not by their words, even when these are words of apology.
Okay, at the back there.
Cover number of points, just sort of responding to your question, I think my personal view is that there will be no apology, because to apologise is to have recognised slavery as a legal crime, in which case that would bring international for the issue of reparations, which isn't going to happen, because either it's not practical or there's not enough money to pay reparations to African people for the impact of slavery. My question to you two would be, sort of, you're specialists, obviously, historians and documenting history, and you know about the African abolitionists that fought for freedom of African people, and perhaps everyone here in this room is interested and say has come, but generally, sort of, young people in schools today aren't taught of these people, say they're taught of war before, and you know, we've got to acknowledge that Britain ended the slave trade and sort of Africa didn't contribute to that at all. Is that what dangers do you see in teaching history for both, say, young black and white people coming up and sort of seeing, you know, the Africans that were enslaved as dependent people that had to, you know, kneel and beg for their freedom from all the force or, you know, Queenie saving them? What dangers do you see for the world for that?
Well, I think you've expressed it very well yourself. If people are taught that, if children are taught that you know, your ancestors received this freedom as a gift from on high, you know, it's not something to be proud of. It puts you in a base position of having received, you know, benevolence from somewhere, and it's not how history actually happened. And are any of you here school teachers? Good. All right. Well, you've got the power to change this. You have the power to teach the history in a different way. And actually, I spoke a few days ago in London to a group of about 50 school teachers. There are groups out there with materials about how to do this. For teachers who want to do this and for schools which will allow you to do this, I don't know how much restrictions there are in British schools, it is possible to teach the history in a different way. It's possible to learn about people like Olaude Aquiano, Sam Sharp, leaders of other slavery veterans, and about some of the abolitionists in Britain itself, like Thomas Clarkson and Elizabeth Hayrick and so on, who, you know, were of a very different mold from the Wilberforce. So we obviously need to get that much, much more into the school curriculum here than it is right now. I think it's tremendously important.
Yeah, just to add very briefly about that is one of the members of Bristol Radical History Group is actually speaking next week, I think in a week's time tonight here, is a teacher, and she's trying to get a lot of Equiano's book into the Bristol schools and hopefully into national curriculum. I mean, you know, I recognise the limitations of that, but those books should be available and they should be out there. I mean, Equiano's book was not really rediscovered until 1960. Yeah. It was lost for 100 years. So, and it's actually cracking read as well if you read it. So it's a good book, and that book, teachers should be pushing for that book to be in schools. I mean, this is the year it should be there. I mean, you know, this is the moment to do that.
I disagree, because I don't think it should be teachers. Students also have the power to do it as well, and school children. So they're a student, and they can also inform the teacher of this, because if they're not going to be informed themselves, then what's wrong with the students themselves or the school children telling the teachers about this?
Well, I'll take that point. But I mean, obviously,
they're not aware.
If
they find out.
So I'll just take a question, Danny.
Yeah, I just wanted Adam mentioned the contested history and challenge and justice today, and that made me think of C.L.R. James when he wrote The Black Jacobins, because he was outraged about the Italian fascist invasion of Abyssinia at the time, of Ethiopia at the time, the then only independent African state, and it seemed to him the message of that book to an emerging African nationalist movement was, do it yourself, no one's going to do it for you, liberate yourselves, that's what Toussaint and the Haitians did. And it seems, it's great we've got this contested abolition thing, and meetings like tonight, congratulations to the speakers and the people who put it on, but so many people who aren't at meetings like tonight are going to get the official history in The Amazing Grace, aren't they? And I just want to know how bad that film actually is, how much I will go see it, but how bad is it? How does it fit into some kind of liberal humanitarianism, Bush and Blair liberating Iraq, Wilberforce liberating the slaves? The kind of opposite narrative that Toussaint was getting at, the Black Jacobins, really.
How bad is the film? Well, it's a very subtle, slick, sophisticated version of the Wilberforce freed the slaves almost single-handedly. It's sophisticated in this way, in that other people that we've mentioned, like Thomas Clarkson, Olaudah Equiano, appear in the film, but they appear in a sort of peculiar way. They appear sort of as sidekicks to Wilberforce, and a lot of the film is told as a sort of extended flashback where Wilberforce is narrating to his beloved the history of the start of this movement and how Thomas Clarkson went charging off on his horse around the country, and you see Clarkson, you know, galloping down the lane, as if Wilberforce sort of dispatched him on this journey. He talks about Olaudah Equiano traveling around the country selling his book, and you see Equiano selling his book with people lined up to buy it, as if that was, you know, because you're hearing it, you the viewer of the film, you're hearing it in Wilberforce's voice, it gives you the impression that he kind of orchestrated all this. He even tells his beloved Barbara about, you know, the sugar boycott, leaving the viewer the impression that he somehow endorsed or organized this, whereas we know he was opposed to it. So that's why I say it's a very sophisticated version of this basically very traditional history. And of course, as some of you may have read, there's an interesting story behind the film. One of its major financiers is Philip Anschutz, the American billionaire who is also trying to get a gambling casino in the Millennium Dome area, and your Deputy Prime Minister, Mr. Prescott, has visited a number of times. Prescott insists they were only talking about their mutual admiration for Wilberforce. And I think the politics involved are that Wilberforce has become, for many people on the far right in the U.S., a sort of a hero, because they can hold him up, they can say he was they like him because he was very conservative on every issue except slavery, and he was even pretty cautious about, you know, just how fast emancipation and slavery should happen as well. And there are many right-wingers in the U.S. Congress, such as Senator Brownback, who's now one of the Republican candidates for presidency, who declare Wilberforce as their great hero. So I think that's why Anschutz, who's a financier of all these causes, you know, anti-abortion, anti the teaching of evolution in schools, and all sorts of things like that, has financed a film about Wilberforce.
Yeah, Joe.
Yeah. History is obviously very
selective. So
should
we boycott
it then? Yeah. Sorry, yeah, Jared.
History is obviously very selective in things like that. I mean, the past, some things have been selected, some have not. Another episode which seems to have been completely passed over was what happened after the American War of Independence. Where after 1784, there were regiments of ex-slaves who actually fought on the side of the British against the colonists. And although the British subsequently lost, those regiments were claimed back as property by the Americans, but the British commanders refused to give them back, even though that was the official policy, apparently. Instead, they were transported to Jamaica, where they were settled as free settlers. So this element seems to just never have been acknowledged or recorded on what influence they had, because these would obviously be an example to the existing slave population in Jamaica, that these were free black men who were in effect had taken the step to free themselves by joining the British and in effect becoming free that way. This would be an example for other people in Jamaica, but this never seems to have been acknowledged at that period.
I'm wondering if those freed slaves settled in Jamaica, and I thought they were all sent to Nova Scotia.
The people who were sent to Nova Scotia were the people in one of the five then existing Maroon towns who were fighting in the Second Maroon War. At least they were sent, and maybe others that I don't know about. But there were two Maroon Wars in Jamaica, and only one of the five towns was involved in the Second Maroon War. And after 5 months, they were still undefeated, and the British general was authorized to make terms of peace with them. And he agreed terms that they would not be re-enslaved or deported if they laid down their arms, which they proceeded to do. The governor then had them arrested and deported. And they were deported, first of all, to Sierra Leone, to Nova Scotia. And those who survived the winter were then transferred and sent to Sierra Leone, where there is still a chapel, Montague's Chapel, named after their leader, who one of the people who was transferred from Nova Scotia to Sierra Leone. That's the only story about transfers to Nova Scotia that I'm aware of.
I think you were asking about an earlier one. That was in 1795. In 1783, at the end of the American War of Independence, there were these former slaves who gained their freedom by coming and fighting on the British side in this war. And some 3,000 of them were sent to Nova Scotia. I don't think any of them were sent to Jamaica. Some 3,000 of them were sent to Nova Scotia. And then about a third of that number then subsequently migrated to Sierra Leone a few years later. But I don't think any of them were sent to Jamaica.
Yeah, I think you're referring to, I mean, I know this is the Simon Sharma book, and I spit when I say that. But this is about the Rough Crossings book, I think he writes about this. But I mean, I don't know what you think when he's read it, but what I would say about that is it's not surprising to me that Simon Sharma would write a book about this curious incident of, you know, the British offering freedom to slaves who were being held by a rebel enemy. So, I mean, I think throughout the history of that period, the British and other states were quite capable in playing games around these people who were owned. to get advantage. I mean, I think you might want to explain, perhaps, for example, in Haiti, when the British invaded Haiti to try and suppress the slave rebellion and seize a French colony, something which Madam said was not something that's very well known about, the French planters, the French slave owners, were cheering them in, inviting the British in, saying, come and sort our slave rebellion out. So I think sides, you know, tactics were used throughout that period by imperial powers, and if that meant, you know, the other side had got slaves, well, we'll give them freedom if they join us. You know, so I personally think that was a complete tactic that was used by the British to win a revolutionary struggle. In fact, they lost. I think it's interesting that Sharma was writing about that and not about perhaps a lot of other things that are much more important than that. Anyway, sorry, the back there, yeah.
You mentioned that the Sardonic Marines in Jamaica escaped from the port. The time which amazes me is how they managed to not be defeated by the establishment at the time, which was obviously very fast, and sort of survive and be liberated. How did they go about that?
How did they what?
How did the Marines survive as an independent Marine?
Well, you see, Jamaica has many mountainous areas into which people could retreat, and the Maroons in Jamaica had established communities in which they were virtually self-governing, and the Treaty of Peace confirmed their right to the land they had settled on and their right to freedom. The Maroon wars that took place there and in Suriname on the South American mainland would not have been possible in most of the Caribbean islands because they lacked an area to which to retreat. The only other island that really had similar conditions was Dominica, and there rebellious slaves who also were called Maroons, did exist for a long time before they were finally suppressed. The Jamaican Maroons survived and were still there.
Jack here.
I want to say thank you for the speaker and thank you for your time. Congratulations our anniversary, the taking celebration, struggle of slavery against their leader, and finally they winner. We never forgetting the struggle, the torture in the prison, in the everything they could against the slavery they did, and finally they won. I want to make a contribution and speak about present time, which is, I wanted to say, slavery never died, it's still on, and just transferring for exploitation, for unemployment, homeless, everything is still on. This government or regime of imperialism, just they making somewhere for for gambling. What is that name?
Casino.
Making just casino, making thinking people all the time, you know, for gambling like that, or for drugs. They bringing drugs from the Colombia for Afghanistan, making people drug just all the time, thinking about the drug, how they can medicine themselves. One of that people is stay on the corner just from this morning until night time, thinking how I can find the, my drug. That killing that people because of they are not can be political against this government, against the regime. They behind the curtain CIA or all the time they be bringing here drugs, and just very small minority people they taking drugs. Oh, we take it, police catch drug. No, your name is there. This is all brainwashing coming from satellite, internet, in the all the world they just stopping a struggle of people, a struggle. Our, with our solidarity, we change the Jack Straw and breaking the link with the government. In the America, Republican breaking the links all the time. They changing the people in the government. I want to say with our solidarity, we can defeat the imperialism. It is not enough just only George Bush or Tony Blair going. Our problem is system, which is overthrew was feudalist in the slavery time, which is you say overthrew. We need that now. You say about the Trinidad, they went make a colony for sugar, now going for oil, like exactly the same colony there. We have to have support resistance in Iraq, in Afghanistan, Palestine, everywhere we can. And finally, I want to say in the fourth anniversary of Iraq is the 20th opposite hippodrome. We have assembly. Hopefully, all of us we coming there, and anything we can to do, because of never will be die this slavery. Which is new slavery for exploitation and many things I said to you.
Thank you.
Mm. I was going to say, what's your question then? Cheers, Jeff. Jim.
Unless we understand our history and where we all came from, we won't understand the present truly and take control of the future. But one thing, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, the remark about Jamaica and the Maroons in Jamaica. My understanding is that when William Penn, who's buried just around the corner in Redcliffe Church, and his armour and his replaced and refurbished pennants are now hanging up in the church, when he took the fleet and was defeated by the Spanish in Haiti and went and took Jamaica, my understanding is that, which was then a small populated island owned by the Spanish, in about 1650, after the English Revolution, the Spanish who owned that island released their slaves, and those slaves went and lived independently in that island. That's my understanding. That's the story I've always believed, that those slaves escaped. And Britain have never, ever, ever ruled the whole island of Jamaica. That's another fantasy that goes on. The centre of Jamaica has always been populated by slaves who freed themselves, who lived independently in the centre of the island. And the plantations only went round the bays and round the circumference of Jamaica. They had to make treaties with the free, independent people, and that's why the Maroons don't have an English name. That's why they have a Spanish or a Latin name, because they weren't originally English slaves at all. They were the names given by the Spanish. There was always an independence, because just like anybody else nowadays, you want to fight for your freedom, you take any chance you can to escape that barbarity. That's my understanding in reply to Jamaica. And, you know, Africans are quite capable of living off the land just like the English are.
A lot of the Maroons in Jamaica do have English names. For example, the fellow who was the leader of a compound for a long time, Colonel Rowe. Rowe was his name. And I came across, on my visits to a compound and to Moortown, I came across a lot of English names.
I meant the name Maroon.
Oh, that was a corruption of the Spanish Cimarron.
Yeah. Pre-English. So there were free slaves living in Jamaica,
yeah.
You know, when Penn and Co. arrived.
Yeah.
Right, I'm just going to take a few more now, unless you want to stay.
I was very captured by the mass movement that was generated in Britain about 200 years ago. I'm kind of thinking of the current situation, and actually in absolute numbers, I think there are more slaves now than there have been, or I've read that somewhere. But obviously there is not the kind of mass movement to correspond with that at all. And one link I did make was when you showed the picture of the sugar jar, and it said, not made by slaves. I couldn't help but think of the fair trade sort of movement that's going on at the moment, which is very sort of sanitised and apolitical and commercial, And I guess what I'm wondering is, what was the political movement back then really that genuine, or was it also tokenistic? And If it was genuine, then how did it happen? And how can we do it today?
That's the big question. How could we do it today? I think one of the things that makes it so much harder to organize about things today is that there isn't a sort of completely clear institution or enemy which can be abolished or eliminated by changing a law. Now, from the point of view of a political organizer, the advantage of working against slavery was that the institution was clear, and you could, and eventually the British Parliament did make a law abolishing slavery. Now, of course, there's a whole other story there. People did not all live happily ever after. The actual living conditions of the former slaves took many, many decades to really improve in a marked way. But it's a lot easier to organize when you have a simple, easy, visible target like slavery, like apartheid in South Africa, which was something that saw an enormous amount of mobilization in many different countries, which I think had a lot to do with bringing pressure that brought about the changes that did happen there. The things about which we have to organize today are much more complicated. Globalization, for example, the world economic trading system, is an immensely complicated thing. There isn't a sort of single thing you can put your finger on and say, there, that has to be changed, that has to be abolished. There are kind of a whole range of things. And then, of course, as you mentioned, once you do set up certain goals, then corporations very quickly get into the act. And in all countries, you can go, now you go to a store and every single product is labeled green or natural or probiotic or fair trade or whatever, and people very quickly jump on board that way. I think it's harder to organize when the institutions and patterns of injustice that we're fighting are so complicated, but I still think that that's no excuse for not doing that kind of organizing, and that it can be done. And I take some heart at the moment in the U.S. from what seems to be a strengthening movement against the war there, although, of course, it's still not yet been successful.
Okay, I've got loads of questions. It's frightening now. Just down the front and at the back.
You mentioned about the Maroons and how they kind of accepted this offer from the British to capture slaves who had run away, and they kind of co-opted with the British in that way, which seems a bit of an awkward point. I was just wondering whether you do put that down to kind of just kind of British divide and rule tactics, or Maroon self-interest, or... How you explain that?
From the British point of view, of course, it was a very smart move, because had the victorious Maroons continued as enemies, they would have had a bad effect in influence on the other slaves, those who were still enslaved, but by co-opting many of the Maroons, because there was nothing, sort of, no official decision on the part of the Maroon community to do this, but individual Maroons were readily recruited in large numbers to serve the establishment in this way. I think it was a very smart move from the point of view of the establishment. As far as looking at it from the Maroon point of view, this was simply a matter of a way of getting a book, of a way of getting money. And the length to which they would go in actually killing people who had been captured so as to get the higher rate until that was changed. I mean, just shows you one of the great weaknesses of human nature, I suppose. If you offer people rewards, you can get them to do all sorts of things. This, after all, is the whole basis of the trade in sex. I mean, if you offer big enough rewards, there will be a large number of people who will serve, who will provide those services. So I think that from the Maroon point of view, it was simply an illustration of the human weaknesses that are so widespread in every community.
Back.
As you mentioned earlier on, the humanization of people, remove all their names, of their ancestry, of their heritage, religion, all those kind of things, and also the capitalistic nature of African enslavement, in that African slavery led to underdevelopment of Africa, which fundamentally meant that the skilled people, the strongest men that were able to build the country or the nation, were taken away. And so there's a massive gap in the generations of in the knowledge, knowledge of film. And I just kind of think it's important that we do recognise that form of slavery is completely different to any form of slavery that does exist today. As you know, as terrible as it is, and as much that we do need to overcome those forms of slavery that do exist today, champion slavery has never kind of taken form again as it is with African people. And it's the same, you can't refer to the Jewish experience of Jewish Holocaust. You can't put any other experience as that similar experience. You can refer to other genocides that have taken place in history, but you can't equate the experience as the same sort of experience. So that's just an African perspective, a specification and an application that I would like to make in references to slavery and African experience of slavery.
I've lost track now.
I want to just make a point about fair trade. In my own experience, in the 1970s, it started more as a cooperative thing, not as a sanitised, commercial thing. It was actually part of the sort of 70s movement before, in the 80s, when green and fair trade was an underground thing in this country. It was a radical thing. It became mainstream because politicians saw that it could be get more votes on it. And I worked in a fair trade cooperative in Bristol for 10 years. And how many people in this room have drunk coffee today, you know? And how many people drunk fair trade coffee, you know? And coffee is allegedly one of the second biggest commodities in the world next to oil, and there's some of the poorest workers, and I think that lady's absolutely right. It's not as terrible as what, you know, what she's just explained, but, you know, the tea workers, the coffee workers, the cocoa workers, are all addicts to coffee, tea, sugar. Sugar addicts, you know, and it's one of the biggest things we can do is to spend our money. What these women did with the sugar, you know, was a really important thing for a lot of people. How we spend our money each day is one of the biggest things we do. And the Maroons lived independently. If we had permaculture everywhere and we made our own stuff, we wouldn't be slaves to a capitalist system where we have to buy everything from the outside. So poor people around the world picking tea for as no schools for their children, and fair trade should give them that chance if everyone bought fair trade. But I mean, in the Windward Islands, there's supposed to be fair trade plantations for bananas and so on. I mean, I don't know, what effect is it having an effect? Is it big enough yet? If everyone bought fair trade, do you think it would do what it could do?
From what little I know about it, I think it has had an effect in the Americas on coffee farming, because there's a considerable push for fair trade coffee in the U.S., and there's some sort of an NGO that sort of certifies things, and that just from what little I've read about it, my impression is that it's had a big effect in terms of encouraging the buying of coffee from, you know, that's grown in from small co-ops, and that's grown in a more ecological manner and so on. But I'm no expert on these things.
Any more? I'm going to a minute, Jack. There's a couple more if anybody is. It's like we're coming to the end, I think. Does anybody else want to speak? Apart from you, Jack.
Just I want to answer this speech my friend said here. I just exactly I said, we never forgetting in slavery time, they struggle, they torture there, and many people they die. We never forgetting and be proud to them even. We can't exactly say in Holocaust what happened exactly to this present time happened. No. It's similarity, just like explained transfer that. For example, there's money of World Bank giving to Africa. African never countries never can back original money to this World Bank, just giving interest. Just giving, they never can give money to them. This is slavery. They come from this money that country is giving to imperialist country. There is killing themselves, hang up themselves. They're selling, not there, many, many places in Asia, everywhere, selling their wives. They haven't the job. They will be more prostitutes, more, many things coming up. No, this is similarity, you know, we just transfer for new technology happened like this. This is another slavery. Wars happen, if you want, I don't want to take your time. I can more explain to you. This is another slavery. We have to have stay resistant against this system. System is just transferred from feudalism to slavery and continuing, you know, to capitalism higher than that is imperialism.
Yeah, right. I'm just going to, unless anybody else got any more questions, and carry on chatting outside. But just say a couple of things just before we finish. First of all, if you want to find out more about the events next week and tomorrow night in the Seven Stars, we've got Harvard and Bristol, very important, the abolitionist history of Bristol. There's leaflets outside. Also, please leave your contact address for emails. We don't send out a lot of stuff. We don't bombard you with rubbish, right? We'll send out an email when we've got some events. And we also are very interested in people, if they're doing historical research or they feel they want to talk about something, that they take this stage as well. That's very important for this group. So I encourage anybody who feels that they've got something to talk about, or done some research, or they'd like to talk about something, then please contact us. Leave your contact address outside, because the Bristol Radical History Group is not a group, it's a mob. It involves everybody, so if you want to get involved, that's the way to do it. And lastly, I'd just like to say a big thank you to Hannah.
lastly, Adam's speaking on Saturday at the Commonwealth Museum, so if you want to go down there and maybe challenge some of the some of the people down there with some of these ideas, then come see Adam down there and get the sleeping outside as well. Cheers for that. If you haven't paid, make sure you pay.